evening. It's an opportunity for us to get into God's Word a little bit more. I might invite you to turn to your Bibles in the 15th chapter of the Gospel of Mark, and we will be looking at the very least, the things that are leading up to the cross and some of the events that happened there, and we'll see how that goes. I invite you to to ask any questions you might have or make any comments that you might feel are appropriate as we go through this. So Mark 15, verse 16 is where we're going to begin. Maybe go as far as verse 41, but I doubt if we'll make it that far. If we do, then who wants to volunteer to sit up in the window? Okay. One of the things I think is interesting, this is just kind of a throwing it out there for you to think about. When you look at the gospel accounts of Christ's death, you would have to say that when it comes to the actual crucifixion itself, the gospel writers show great restraint in giving out the details and description of what it was like for Jesus dying on the cross. That's kind of interesting. Many times it just builds up to that point and they crucified him. Some of them will talk about what he said and the conversations that he had with the thief who died with him, or maybe with his mother and John the Apostle, and some of that goes on. But they, as a whole, they don't really deal with that. They don't deal with that. One writer by the name of James Edwards said, "There is no intention to exploit the savagery of crucifixion, either to sensationalize Jesus' death or to evoke sentimentality from the reader. Just simply tells us what it is." Now, they would have been a lot more familiar with crucifixion than we are, and so at that time it would have meant more to them in the sense of actual experiencing it. But Mark's account is not so much on the death of Christ by crucifixion. He spends more time talking about the shame and mockery that Jesus endured. So as we go through here, you'll notice it begins in the Jewish court and it continues with the Roman soldiers prior to the cross. And it continues into the crucifixion scene itself with not only the soldiers, but also his fellow, the thieves on either side and the passerbys and all of that. So there's just a real emphasis on the shame and the humility, the mockery that Jesus experienced. I think that's what we want to look at for a moment. So beginning in chapter 15, in verse 16, we'll read through verse 20. "The soldiers took him away into the palace," that is, the praetorium, "and they called together the whole Roman cohort. They dressed him up in purple, and after twisting a crown of thorns, they put it on him, and they began to acclaim him, 'Hail, King of the Jews!' They kept beating his head with a reed and spitting on him, and kneeling and bowing before him. After they had mocked him, they took the purple robe off him and put his own garments on him, and they led him away to crucify him." Okay, quite a lot said there. The soldiers took him away into the palace, praetorium. Some think that might be part of the palace, but maybe sort of a porch area where you might be able to be in the praetorium and not really be in the palace itself. In any case, they took him away to this and called together the whole Roman cohort. Who were these soldiers? Well, they're Roman soldiers. They could have been soldiers that were already stationed there in Jerusalem. They could have been soldiers who accompanied Pilate from his home in Caesarea by the sea. It could have been some other soldiers, but there was a contingent of soldiers there who obviously enjoyed crucifying people in a sick, sadistic sort of way. So they are there. And verse 17 says, they dressed him up in purple, and after twisting a crown of thorns, they put it on him. Remember, Jesus had already been scourged, a beating that sometimes called the half death because of its severity. He's already been beaten, scourged. And the bloodthirsty mob still wasn't satisfied. They wanted more, and they were coached into asking that he be crucified. Why would you dress him up in purple? Okay, a color of royalty. This is okay, this is an act of mockery. I think when you read through here a couple of times, you begin to get the idea that Pilate and the Romans have had their share of trouble with insurrectionists. And they really didn't care much for the Jews. And so later when they pronounce the charge against Jesus, it just flies in the face of what the religious leaders wanted. They wanted something different, like he claims to be, not that he is the king of the Jews. So they're taking that phrase, king of the Jews, which was actually the accusation upon which he was condemned to death. Well, you say, well, I thought he was condemned as a blasphemer. And he was, by the Jewish court. This is blasphemy. Wouldn't everybody agree that he deserves to die? Yes. Well, we can't kill anybody. The Romans took away our right to kill anybody. So we got to meet together early in the morning, and we got to decide what charge to lay on him as he goes to Pilate. And so they decided that they would jump on this opportunity. Somebody had said something about, he said, you destroy this temple and I will rebuild it in 3 days. And in essence, basically saying something that in their minds could be interpreted to be, he's trying to be a king. And so when they brought the charges to Pilate, it was, he claimed to be the king of the Jews. And that's why John 18, when Jesus stands before Pilate, one of the first questions Pilate asks is, what? Are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus said something like, are you saying that on your own initiative, or does somebody tell you about me? And he says, yes, I am a king. But then he explains, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting. But as it is, I'm not a kingdom of this realm. So, yeah, so they're hinging on that idea. And as they go through this matter, the Jews, let me just put it this way. The Romans are saying, here is a man. This is all that the Jews could muster. This is all that they could build up. This is the only thing that they could, this is all the strength they have to overthrow Rome, is this man who wouldn't say anything, whom we beat to a pulp, and now we're going to go crucify him, and laughing not only at Christ, but at the Jews themselves. In a sense, you see that to be the case. So they dressed him in purple, royalty. I think Matthew 27 uses the word scarlet, and I guess in a sense there might have been a different shades of this royal color, scarlet being one, and scarlet being more the color that we think of, the Roman soldiers would wear that color. Purple, scarlet are closely related to each other. But it's a color of purple. Remember anybody in the New Testament who is associated with purple? Lydia, a seller of purple fabrics. And where they got that purple? Probably some seashells or animals of a certain kind that they would get under the sea and divers would get, and they would use that to color their fabrics. But this word robe is a oblong shaped garment with a fastened around the neck, a brooch. And so you have this thing around you, this brooch, and and this purple scarlety material that would resemble royalty. It's not intended to be exactly that. I don't believe these soldiers went and found a real high-priced robe out here and brought it to him. They might have just taken off an old rag or an old robe off of somebody that was wearing it and put it on him. It happened to be of that color. So they had this. They were making a mockery of him as a king. Okay? What else did the soldiers do to mock Jesus? Oh, some of them had the wonderful idea, let's put a crown on his head. And so they twisted some thorns together to make a crown. And these are not the little prickly things. These are the big spiked crowns. And they put it on his head. And that kind of looked like, well, he's got a crown. The kings had crowns, but they were comfortable and they were glorious and showed honor to the king. He's got a crown of thorns. And you know, when you read a lot of the... or not when you read, but when you see pictures of Jesus on the cross, artist renderings of this, you know, they really don't know what Jesus looked like, and they don't really know everything about it, but this is their impression of what he may have looked like. A lot of them, he still has that crown of thorns on his head when he's on the cross. I don't know if they left it on there after they finished mocking him or not, but they put that crown on his head not just as a way of making fun of him, but it was part of the torture, part of the pain that he endured. And I think we'll see that a little bit later on in this passage. The thorns would penetrate the scalp. Yes. Yeah, that's something that when we get to that part where they take it off, you have to think about, well, first, if you were feeling like that, you wouldn't want anything touching your back. You put a robe on there, and you're making fun of him, and tearing it off would seem a little bit like tearing off a raw bandage of some kind. It wouldn't have been pleasant at all. And so, having done this, they began to acclaim him. Hail, King of the Jews. Hail, which is kind of an expression of greetings, good health to you, long life to you. Hail, that's kind of like they would do with that regular king. Hail to you, and King of the Jews. And verse 19 says, they kept beating his head with a reed. Okay, the language in the original is a continual thing. They kept beating. They didn't just smack him on the head once. They kept smacking him on the head. Now, what has he got on his head? Crown of thorns, which means that this is part of the painful torture that they were having. Well, the reed is mentioned, I think, in the book of Matthew, I believe it is, that it was used in part of the getup. You put the crown of thorns on, the robe that is purple, you put in his hand a reed, and then you're hail, King of the Jews, take the reed out of his hand, smack him on the head a few times. And this continued to go on as they mocked Jesus. Verse 19 says, they kept beating his head with a reed and spitting on him and kneeling and bowing before him. This was, to them, this mockery was an activity of excitement. They so hard-hearted that this became really what they enjoy doing. So you think about that for a moment. Imagine that. If it said kept beating, and the phrase spitting on him is connected with a conjunction and, means they kept on spitting at him. This was spitting, of course, would be an insult. It still is today, isn't it? Have somebody spit on you? I know Jesus used spittle on occasions to perform miracles, a little different context, but this is an act of disgust and an insult to him. Okay, so the reed became a club. club him on the head. Spitting was an insult. Who else spit on Jesus besides the Roman soldiers? In chapter 14, verse 65, after they accused Jesus of blasphemy, they condemned him to be deserving of death. Verse 65 of Mark 14, and some began to spit at him and to blindfold him and to beat him with their fists and to say to him, prophesy. And the officers received him with slaps in the face. So before Jesus was ever turned over to the Romans, he had been going through this kind of stuff. Even in or during the period of religious, the Jews, the chief priests, the scribes, these people, they're trying to find a charge against Jesus. And it's not a trial, where we would say, we're arresting you on the grounds of this or whatever because premeditated murder or robbery or whatever. He was arrested so that they could bring him in and find something to charge him with. That's totally illegal, by the way. But as they're doing that, finally, he cannot deny who he is. He admits to the fact that he is, in fact, the Son of God. And they condemn him, and they began to spit at him. The same people that were supposed to be just and fair. And why did they blindfold him? Part of the same thing, isn't it? They blindfolded him and beat him with their fists. We don't realize how much Jesus suffered before he went through the scourging. But they beat him with the fist and then would say, okay, prophesy. Who is the one who hit you? And this is one of those games that, and these officers may have been officers of the temple or Roman soldiers, I don't know for sure, but so he's endured a lot before he even came under the mockery of the Roman soldiers. Okay. Now, Isaiah 50, verse 6. Isaiah 50 and verse 6. Isaiah has a lot to do about describing in a certain section of Isaiah. It's called a suffering servant. A lot of messianic statements that directly apply to Christ. But here it says this. It might have a dual fulfillment here. He said, I gave my back to those who strike me, and my cheeks to those who pluck out the beard. I did not cover my face from humiliation and spitting. Well, Isaiah endured a lot. And some of the prophecies or statements are also applied to Jesus. But you'll notice that the humiliation of spitting upon him. Mark chapter 10, verse 44, Jesus himself made this prophecy. So you have the prophecies of the Old Testament fulfilled in the suffering of Christ, and then you have the prophecies of Jesus, who understood the Old Testament prophecies and applied them to himself. So in Mark 10, 34, he told his disciples, they will mock him, that is the Son of Man, they will mock him and spit on him and scourge him and kill him. And 3 days later, he will rise again. This is what the disciples could not get through. They couldn't understand it. They had trouble accepting it or applying it to Jesus. But the prophecy came exactly true. Jesus was mocked, he was spit upon, he was scourged and killed. 3 days later, he rose from the dead. So here we have the mockery of Jesus, and it goes deep. It runs deep in the soldiers' way of thinking. Any questions, comments up to this point? Good point. Like a sheep is silent before its shearers, so he opened not his mouth. That's true. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, they were doing they were crayfishing. They were pulling back on it, and they might say, "Well, Pilate did it. The Romans did it. And Pilate had washed his hands of it. Pilate had found no reason to, no guilt at all in the man." But they wanted crucifixion. In fact, they even said, the crowd said at least, "His blood be upon us and our children." That's a horrible thing for them to have said. Yeah. Yes. So, some of the things said there, you know, you might say poetic justice. I don't know. Yes, go ahead, Rick. That's an interesting, you know, sometimes things come up like that, and we say, well, that's pretty interesting. The Revelation doesn't say that, but when the people were saying his blood be upon us, they had probably no idea that Jesus is thinking, and get on this later, the destruction of Jerusalem. When they said, his blood be upon us and our children. The destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 was a mighty fulfillment of the consequence for what they had done. People can do horrific things and then all of a sudden say, well, I really didn't do it. They might try to rewrite history or something. But the evidence is right there. They did it. Okay. So in verse 20, we mentioned this earlier. After they had mocked him, they took the purple robe off him and put his own garments on him, and they led him away to crucify him. Okay. It's kind of interesting that, as already mentioned, by now Jesus would have looked almost unrecognizable, really, wouldn't he? A blood-covered face. Blood dripping down from his head, those lashes, sometimes on some occasions taking out an eye. I mean, he's a bloody pulp of a mess. And they put this robe on him, and later they decide to remove the robe and put his own garments back on him. So you look at that, you say, well, that's kind of a hard thing to think about. Especially when you think about later, they would cast lots for the garments. These garments were blood-stained. And I don't know why you'd want them, but that's part of what they did. But, you know, criminals often went to their crucifixion and through the crucifixion completely naked. It's possible that he might have had a loincloth on. But we know when they got to the place, they divided up the garments, four soldiers, and I think they might have taken the turban and I'll get to that later, the different parts of their garments, and divided those up and then gambled for his outer tunic. We'll mention that in just a moment. So the soldiers led Jesus out of the city to crucify him. John says he went out bearing his own cross. We talked last time a bit about the fact that it very likely could have been just the cross beam. And think that probably is the case. Cross standing for the whole thing, but he's carrying the cross beam, which itself would have been very heavy and very hard for someone to carry, but especially if they had been beaten like he had been beaten and punished the way he had already been punished. So he carries this cross. Plutarch is a name you might recognize if you're familiar with ancient history. He said, every criminal who goes to execution must carry his own cross on his back. And carrying this cross would have just added to the shame. You think of the most shameful, humiliating thing that could happen. You'd say, well, to be crucified, to be mocked, to carry your own cross to your own death, unbelievable shame. And to carry it through the streets of Jerusalem, not necessarily a straight line, but in a way to expose his condemnation to as many people as possible, and then to bring him outside the city gates. Why is a point made here for bringing Jesus outside the gates of the city? Does it relate to the scapegoat? Well, the whole sacrificial system, including the scapegoat, relates to Christ. What else? Pardon me? Right. They were not to execute someone within the city limits. Hebrews 13 says in verse 12, therefore Jesus also, he tells us, let us go to him outside the camp. Well, it's kind of relates to being willing to be persecuted. Let's go to him outside the camp. And he says there in that passage that he might sanctify the people through his own blood. He suffered outside the gate. So, and really in the Old Testament, there's a couple of places. I don't seem to have them right here. I might get them later in my notes. But where it specifically states in the book of Leviticus, outside the camp. But that was not by crucifixion. That was by stoning. If Jesus had been killed by the Jews directly without the Roman involvement, he would have been stoned to death outside the city. But the prophecy is that he would be crucified. How did Isaiah and these other prophets know that he would be crucified when stoning is the means of execution among the Jewish people? God told him what was going to happen outside the gates. So that's kind of an interesting idea. In verse 21 through 28, let me read that and we'll move on a little bit, some interesting facts here. The crucifixion at Golgotha. They pressed into service a passerby coming from the country, Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to bear his cross. Then they brought him to the place Golgotha, which is translated place of a skull. They tried to give him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him and divided up his garments among themselves, casting lots for them to decide what was each man should take. It was the third hour when they crucified him. The inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." They crucified two robbers with him, one on the right and one on the left. And the scripture says that the scripture was fulfilled, which says, "And he was numbered with transgressors." Okay. Again, stress the brevity of Mark's gospel. There's just a lot of things that are in the other gospels that aren't in Mark. And that's okay, because to understand the complete picture, you need to read all three of them. But there's a number of things that are missing here, and I'll let you study that out yourself. And the brevity of Mark is also seen in, it records only one saying of Christ. And there, we know there were seven sayings of Christ from the cross. But Mark's account, as you remember, was written to what, primarily to what group of people? Romans. So Mark is interested more in what Romans were thinking to appeal to them. And so it's briefer for that reason. They just wanted the simple facts. Appealing to the Romans also, you'll find that in Mark, many times when something is said, he'll explain it or translate it for his readers. Again, that suggests it was going to Romans, those who are Romans. Okay, so Jesus is suffering outside the camp. Verse 21 says, they pressed into service a passerby coming from the country, Simon of Cyrene, a father of Alexander and Rufus, to bear his cross. So what does that mean about Jesus and his condition at this time? He couldn't carry it. Now, some of our songs, and well, I think there's some songs that suggest that he fell beneath the cross, and I kind of think that's probably what happened, but I also can't find that in the gospel accounts. It just says they pressed him into service. So here's a guy coming into town and happens to be passing by, and they seize him. You carry that. No choice. And the background for that is kind of interesting, because that's what the Romans could do. I mean, Cyrus, the king of Persia, had set up a system whereby there was a postal office every day's journey, and the people who delivered, or the couriers or whatever they were, they could commandeer somebody's animal or the person to whatever resources they needed to get the message through. That system was then adopted by the Romans, who expanded it to basically mean that the Roman soldiers could ask you to carry something for such and such a distance, every couple of miles or whatever. 1 mile, I guess it was. And Jesus said, if they compel you to do 1 mile, do 2 miles. Remember him saying that. So that same kind of thing is here. You need to carry this cross for him. He had no choice in the matter whatsoever. So let's talk about this Simon guy for a little bit here. Where was he from? Cyrene. Here's what's interesting. You know, why would Mark come out in his gospel and mention Simon, who was from Cyrene, whose sons were Alexander and Rufus? A lot of times you don't have mentions that detailed, except for the fact that maybe these are people who were familiar to Mark and familiar to perhaps some of the Romans. So you got Simon of Cyrene. Let's go back to Acts chapter 2 and just kind of explore this idea of Cyrene for a moment. Am I pronouncing that right? I don't know. Acts chapter 2 and verse 10. On the day of Pentecost, there were Jews from all over the world there. And in verse 10, he mentions Phrygia, Pamphylia, Egypt, and the districts of Libya around Cyrene, and visitors from Rome, both Jews and proselytes. So on the day of Pentecost, there were people from Cyrene. And as we indicated here, it was around Libya, northern edge of Africa. These people were there on the day of Pentecost. So if he was from Cyrene, that's where he originated from. Okay, let's look at chapter 6 and verse 9. It's kind of interesting here that it's connected to Stephen's problem that he had. It says there were some men from what was called the synagogue of the freedmen, including both Cyrenians and Alexandrians, and some from Cilicia and Asia, rose up and argued with Stephen. Now, they weren't able to cope with Stephen's arguments, but they thought they got the last word in by killing him. But at that meeting, at that situation, there were Cyrenians and Alexandrians. Alexandria is also Egypt, center of learning, not too far from Cyrenia. So you had these people who, in that occasion, were enemies. Acts chapter 2, they had become Jews, right? Proselyte. They were Jews who had settled in Cyrene. Okay, let's look up another example. In Acts chapter 11 and verse 20, there's a church in Antioch, the most predominant church in the early part of the Christianity was Jerusalem. A few years later, one of the most prominent churches was to the north in Antioch of Syria. This is a church that sent out the Apostle Paul and Barnabas and sent them out a second time and a third time. This was a center of evangelism. And this is what we read about them in Acts chapter 11 and verse 20. There were some of them, well, it says before that, those who were scattered by the persecution connected with Stephen made their way to Phoenicia and Cyprus and Antioch, speaking the word to no one except Jews alone. But, verse 20 says, there were some of them, men of Cyprus and Cyrene, men of Cyrene, who came to Antioch and began speaking to the Greeks also, preaching the Lord Jesus. That's talking about the beginning of the church in Antioch. They were converts from Cyrene involved in that. And then there's just one more. Chapter 13, verse 1. It says, now there were at Antioch in the church that was there prophets and teachers, Barnabas and Simeon, who is called Niger, and Lucius of Cyrene, and Manaen, who had been brought up with Herod the Tetrarch and Saul. It's just kind of interesting here that this church in Antioch became very strong. It had multiple preachers and prophets, and one had a name, Simeon. The name Simon is a variant of the name Simeon, very common name. And Lucius is from Cyrene. It would be interesting to know if this person who carried the cross might have been converted and become a Christian. Not saying it happened, but it's a possibility. In fact, there is, I'm going to have to close here pretty soon. But in fact, archaeologists found an inscription in Jerusalem with the name Simon the Cyrene. And in that inscription, it says he was from Cyrene. Simon. I might get this wrong. It mentioned Alexander and Rufus, sons of Simon of Cyrene, which would be interesting to if that was the case, maybe in a place where they buried the dead in one of the caves, I think, there, or manufactured caves, if that were so. It's just an interesting thought. I'm going to pause with one thought here, and we'll come back later and finish this up. I was just wondering, if you were the passerby guy, Simon, and later you were converted to Christ, it's not beyond the realm of possibility that that may have happened, to have been able to look back and to say, I had no idea at the time, but I was carrying the cross of Christ. How would that affect you? And to realize that Jesus teaches us that we've got to carry the cross. We have to take up his cross daily and follow him. It's something to think about. And as we draw a lesson to a close, we want to close with an invitation. If we can pray with you, pray for you, if we can help you in your obedience to Christ, we want to do so. We just want, as Christians, as we read that great story, to be affected in our thinking, in our mentality, in our emotions, in our whole being, to think about Jesus, the one who loved and died for us. If you need to come, I invite you to come while we stand and while we sing.